Good evening, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to the Naturalist Capitalist. It is a good day today. Had a pretty good day. I hauled a D10 this morning. Let's see. Also, Donald Rumsfeld died, so that's great. And of course, I got Bill Barger on the show, so it's a good day. How's it going, Bill?
What's happening, dude? Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is the first, it's not the first video, but it's the first episode I've done since Pork Fest. And I got a lot of pictures of Pork Fest. And a lot of the people that I've been listening to for a while are much shorter than I kind of envisioned them being. I got a picture next to Tom Woods, and everyone thought I was a giant. And I'm not a giant, I'm a pretty regular sized person. I'm 6 feet tall. But you actually are a giant. How tall are you, anyways?
Dude, I'm 6'8". Do not grow this tall.
That sounds like a pain. Especially, how are airplanes for you?
Dude, I don't. There's a reason I'm always driving across country. Yeah, airplanes suck. No, but it's like it the world. Everybody's like, "Oh, it must be so nice being tall because of the top shelf or whatever." It's like it's not. The world is not built for tall people. It's
Yeah.
nothing is built for tall people. I live in Manchester, New Hampshire, too, where it's like everything was built by French Canadians who are about 5'2", and every door is a different height. I don't even
Right.
know if I have to duck going through them.
Because doors are built at 6'8", right? Isn't that pretty typical? Or
Well,
you can tell us if it's true or not.
standard is yes. In Manchester, no. They're all built by like 5'2" Frenchies 150 years ago. So they're all
Right.
like, oh, I think that's high enough. Like that's they just leave it there.
Yeah. So yeah, tell us a little about yourself. Are you native to New Hampshire like me, or were you born somewhere else and moved there, or what's your deal?
I grew up in New Hampshire. I grew up in Manchester, and I've got 11 siblings. So that was like an interesting, raising. I grew up like super Catholic and conservative or whatever. And over time, I just kind of like stopped believing anything that I was told. You know, it started with like my parents never told us Santa Claus was real, and I always credit them with my skeptical nature, because when you're like 6 years old and it was like Santa Claus is real, he's bringing us all presents, I'm like, you guys are a bunch of fucking idiots. And so I didn't buy that. And then by 10 years old, my parents are super religious, and I came home and it was like, I didn't come home saying in fifth grade like I don't believe in Santa anymore. It was like, Dad, is God real? It's like, so that whole
Damn.
conversation happens. Yeah. And then I
Yeah.
just wasn't sold. So I don't know, I kind of been a skeptic for a while. And then I guess, as far as the political shit, obviously this is a libertarian podcast goes, I get sucked into the political sphere in the Ron Paul days. 'Cause like I liked Obama when I was a kid. It's probably like 16 or 15 when Obama first ran. And the longer I watched him talk, the more I was like, this guy is like empty. Like nothing he says is of any substance. It's like empty platitudes that sound real nice in the moment, but really like there's no substance. And if you look at what's going on, like there's no hope or change here. It's just the same old shit with a new fresh face.
Yeah.
It's
So
like
was
when
Ron
chip bags change the packaging.
was Ron Paul the first guy that you ever heard where you thought, "Wow, this guy's really telling the truth?" Or are there any other figures, whether they're political or religious or anything, that came before him, even if they weren't right on everything? Was there anyone who really made you think, "Oh, wow, that guy's right about this?" Or was it really until Ron Paul when you were like, "Oh, wow, someone's finally saying something that's true"?
I mean, just before that, probably a year before that, somebody told me they knew what good weed was. And I was like, this guy's really telling the truth. But politically, no, it's Ron Paul.
Yeah. Man, I mean, I've got a similar background to you. I grew up in New Hampshire. My parents were Baptist, not Catholic, but same deal. Like I don't know how institutionalized you were with religion, but with me, it went deep. Like it was Sunday, go to church, Wednesday, go to prayer meeting. During the summer, you went to Christian camp. We did vacation Bible school. We did 5 day clubs. We would do all sorts of events all the time. were you immersed in it, or was it just kind of, you have to believe this and we'll leave it at that?
So, kind of varied over time, but like definitely growing up, like my dad published he founded a Catholic book publishing company. It's like a book publishing company that published Catholic books. And so we went to church every Sunday, and it was a big part of life. Oh, I got to let this cat out of, oh, no, thank you. My girlfriend's cat was trying to get out, but she let him out. So it was like, it was definitely immersive. And my dad's also got like a PhD in philosophy. So every day at dinner, it would be like, sit down and like, you know, he would like basically be holding a seminar. So he'd be teaching like whatever, like philosophical principles, and then also going in on like religion and why God is the only reason the universe exists, which was a lot of fun, to be honest. Like looking back, and I'm like, who talks to their kids about this? But I'm grateful.
Yeah, my parents did too, so you aren't alone. What were they like with your questioning? My parents are actually pretty good with it. I mean, I think I probably first started asking concerning questions when I was like 16, and then by the time I was 22, when I was out of the house and everything, that's when I finally said, okay, this is all bullshit. But I started asking some really, you know, really foundational questions when I was in high school, and they were like, they were willing to sit down and talk with me. They weren't dismissive or freaking out, or, you know, calling the pastor and saying, you need to come to the house right now and lay hands on this boy. And, you know, and by the way, for some people that doesn't mean what you mean it, what you think it means if you're not religious. what were they like with you? Were they, accepting or willing to actually talk it out, or were they just like, oh, you can't think that?
So it was like a talk it out until we disagreed, and then you just have to accept it because you live in our house. Because I'll argue all day long. That's like my thing. I love to debate. And like, that's not a new thing. But so, you know, my parents having 11 kids or 12 kids, I can only imagine they were this, you know, I was ninth. They'd already been beaten down by eight before me. So, you know, me coming along and being exceptionally stubborn, they're probably like, yeah, we'll talk with you. We'll talk it out. Let's hash it out. We'll tell you why we believe we'll do it. All right, well, listen, you got to go to church every Sunday whether you like it or not, kid. You know, we can't talk forever, and it sounds like we're not convincing you. So there's rules, but it's also like, all right, you don't have to believe it, but you have to do what we're saying. And again, I can respect that. You know, it was like they gave me some structure.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I appreciate just the knowledge. I mean, I know the Bible better than most Christians do, and, you know, okay, that's fine. You know, that's knowledge that I wouldn't have otherwise. And it also increased your vocabulary as a kid, that's for sure, because there's some pretty heavy reading you have to do in the Bible and, you know, in literature surrounding biblical thoughts or whatever. And I mean, it made you think about stuff that you probably wouldn't have thought about otherwise. So, I mean, yeah, it certainly got some value to it. So have you noticed a correlation between religious things that you're not supposed to question or touch, and then you also see that in society in other areas, not just religion, but especially with politics? There's certain figures you're not supposed to vilify or demonize. You're just supposed to leave those sacred cows alone. You could talk about these things over here, but don't touch that one. That one is untouchable, undebatable. If you go there, you're the worst person on earth. Have you noticed that kind of exists in all areas of life?
Yeah, I mean, it's like everybody wants to have an authority that they can appeal to, so they don't have to, when they can't answer the question themselves, say, well, here's where we find the answer for this. And if it was somebody or something, whether it was like ancient or recent, that was in this class of people, you know, you don't question or you don't say bad things about them because they were just helping guide us towards the light of freedom or righteousness or goodness or whatever it is. Yes. Why did you have somebody in mind?
Well, I mean, yeah, I've got a lot of people in mind. but I don't know. I don't really know if there is such a thing as sacred. You know, I mean, there are things that I care about very dearly, but I will talk to people about why I hold them dearly, why I care about those things, why those things give me a reason to live. But a lot of people aren't willing to go there. You know, they don't want to peel back the onion and really dig into why they believe that or why they think this thing is so great. They obviously haven't actually thought it through and internalized it. It's just something they were taught to do or something that makes them comfortable, so they just go with it. Or I think that's what it is mostly. What do you think about that?
So are you saying that as far as the people holding things sacred, a lot of times they don't know why it's sacred to them, and so it's like an appeal to authority?
Yeah, well, why?
I guess I'm not sure that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so they don't want to talk about why they hold them dearly. And do you think that's because they've either just been told to do that, or it makes them comfortable and they're just afraid that if they really try to digest it and dig in, that they're going to find out that it might not make as much sense as they think it does? So is the lack of willingness to talk about sacred or really important things really a sign of insecurity because they don't want to be convinced that, you know, maybe this thing that you care about so much is actually bullshit?
Man, if I had to guess, I think most people aren't so afraid of cognitive dissonance as we'd like to pretend. I think most people are much more afraid of being unpopular. And so when it comes to like a sacred cow or something like that, I think more often somebody is going to not go there because they don't know, you know, what the reaction is going to be when they come out on the other side. Less than they're afraid it's not going to sit with it. Like, listen, people change all the time. You know, if they really think it's better, they'll change. Like, I know people who have been 350 plus pounds and like lost a bunch of weight and changed their whole lifestyles. And it's like a lot more work than just like coming to a different conclusion about the way the world works. I know it's like work, but like, you know, you have to do a lot more actual stuff in your life. People are like, well, it's hard to say you've been wrong for all those times. Like, somebody who's fat, who lost a bunch of weight, is admitting they were wrong for a long time, you know, and then they're also doing a whole bunch about it. That granted,
so it might
popular.
Also
go ahead.
It might
ahead.
Also it might also be the work that they have to do if they realize that they think differently about something when they actually go through it. Is that kind of what you're saying? Like, people are trying to avoid, they're trying to avoid responsibility, maybe. So that's why they don't want to think it all the way through, or.
I mean, I guess you could say that. I think it's like, maybe social consequence, right? Listen, if you've been a Democrat for your whole life and you decide to become a Republican or something, a lot of your friends are going to disown you or whatever. They're going to be pissed off at you. Like, how could you believe right. this? That's the fallout. That's the work there, is to either maintain or rebuild relationships you would have had. Unlike, you know, if it's losing weight, it's like your lifestyle. That's a whole different set of lifestyle choices than somebody who's like decided that they're going to, you know, they've redefined what, where their beliefs are, or yeah. how they determine or reach their beliefs, I should say.
Yeah. I don't, you know, I have a bit of a mixed philosophy when it comes to trying to reach those types of people with whatever it is. I feel like if you demonize them, I mean, if you go after them and you call them bad names and you belittle them, that's extremely ineffective. And sometimes your insult might be a compliment to them too. Like, if you're screaming at, like, I mean, if you're screaming at a literal Nazi, a neo-Nazi, that they're a Nazi, they're not going to care. Like, so what? You know, I don't really care. Or if you're screaming at someone who is not a Nazi, that they are a Nazi, they're just going to build walls up immediately and not want to listen to you. But at the same time, I feel like if you can direct that at their heroes, it doesn't always have the same effect. I mean, sometimes if you can just shit on their heroes and expose them for how worthless they are, that has some effect sometime. I mean, I do that all the time politically, and a lot of people get mad at me because they think that I'm just going to push people away, but I've found that it's not really what happens. It actually gets people interested and like, whoa, you know, that's kind of a good point, or this guy has something to say, or wow, this guy actually went there and talked about this person like that. And it can open up conversation. But I mean, you tend to have kind of provocative messaging too sometimes. And I was just wondering, what do you think? Like, what's the line there between vilifying people and scaring them away and like just shitting on their structure that they've come to worship over the years?
I like to shit on people with the truth at all times possible. So like, if you can shit on people, if you can shit on something like, and also be saying something that is true, where like the people who can see truth will see like how this is either hilarious and true or like disgusting and true or appalling and true, then you tend to get the right people heading for the hills and the right people being like, oh, I see what they're talking about, you know? So just encapsulating a little bit of truth in there, I think, is probably the secret to that, because you're never going to make everybody happy. Even if you go with the safest message ever, you're never going to make everybody happy, because people want some more interesting shit. So there's no winning, right? There's no getting everybody. If you have, let's say you picked the safest message ever, and then 90% of people liked it, but 10% of people didn't, and the 10% of people were the hardcore activists that actually would do something, it's like, well, then you've lost your most valuable audience. So you kind of have to know who you're driving away and who you're keeping, I guess, would be the secret. I don't know what the line is. Depending on how you do it is probably the answer. It's like it's an art more than it's like a technique, I guess. Like, and I'm blessed to be around some great, great people who are really good at that.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, there's a place for, you know, just spouting economic theories or talking about interest rates or whatever. I mean, there's definitely a place for that educational exposition, but at the same time, you need people who are going to grab attention and who are going to interest other people in what's going on. Because if we were all if we were just all intellectual economists just talking about stuff that nobody has a clue about, that's not really a way to grow a movement or bring attention to things that are going on. And a lot of people get upset when when people are bold or when people say something that is extremely controversial and going against the grain. But those are the people who tend to bring the conversation to normies. You know, like, I mean, the guy who's just sitting on the side of the road spouting boring platitudes might think that he's the gateway for the normies, but often it's when someone says something shocking that if you're a normie, you're like, whoa, okay, that made me think about that. You know, I want to hear more about that. You know, I mean, it seems like that, whether it was a George Carlin moment or something that Ron Paul said on stage, or I don't know, you know, something that one of your friends did in life that was really brave. Those are the type of moments that really stick with you and make you rethink everything about your life. It's not typically someone who's written a brilliant essay that's worded perfectly and isn't going to scare anybody. You know what I mean? It seems like it's those moments, those jarring moments that really catch people's attention and make them reconsider the propaganda they've been brought up with.
Yeah, man, that was, so at Borkfest, they do the annual rant competition, which is called Soapbox Idol. And it's like, they've got 2,500 libertarians in town. Every libertarian loves to rant and pontificate. And they had a fucking competition, a rant competition. They had auditions during the week. And I don't know exactly how many, it was like between 15 and 20 people got in and did their rants. And I fucking won that shit, ranting on exactly what you just said there, which is that you have to be willing to piss people off. You have to. People have to be jarred out of their sleepy willingness to just do whatever they're told. There's no fucking way out of it, because most people are just going to do what they're told. That's the reality of it, until they're really, really either forced to rethink it or get so uncomfortable that they can't do it, or somebody else breaks the thing that they're being forced to do. My example was the TSA line, which is just like, my friend skips the fucking TSA line every time. he opts out or whatever. And it takes forever. It takes like two extra people to come over. Somebody has to pat him down. I think he has to sign some form. It like wastes a bunch of time. And it's like 10% of people did that. And they were willing to just wait out the line, spend an extra hour and a half, whatever it is in line. They would need so many more TSA agents. They wouldn't be able to man the body scanners. They have to revamp their whole system. And you'd break one part of it. But in the meantime, you'd have 90% of people in line being like, will you just shut the fuck up so I can get this over with? I'm trying to take the barbed dildo in my ass, you know, and get this over with and out of the way real quick, because I don't want to be humiliated in public and you're making a scene about it. You know, if you weren't making a scene about it, this whole humiliation process would only take 10 or 15 seconds. And now you're making it take an hour for all of us. And that really bothers a lot of people. You have to be able to piss people off if you're ever going to make a difference, or be willing to piss people off, I should say. Not be able to, but because I don't think it's necessary to piss people off. But if you're unwilling to, you're only ever going to make safe decisions.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's true. And I can't think of anyone I admire who has never pissed someone off at some point. I mean, anyone who's doing something, especially if everybody else is headed in the wrong direction, if you're going to say, hey, no, this is wrong, we're supposed to be going the other way, of course you're going to make people angry. Do you think there's a line with getting attention and how do I word this the right way? Do you think there's a point where getting attention no longer becomes valuable if that's the only point? In other words, if you can grab people's attention by saying something really shocking, but then you don't back it up with anything, or the shocking thing you've said has just been for shock factor and it's not actually making people think about something important, that's when I would say that you've just gone, I mean, maybe not too far, but you've just not accomplished anything. Do you think there's a point where that happens? Like, you can just be so obtuse and so shocking and so vulgar, or whatever, but you're not really adding anything to the conversation. That, I mean, you're not, you haven't accomplished anything, I guess. Not you specifically. I'm just saying in general.
Yeah, I think there's probably a line. I think it's probably farther than most people think it is, but I think there's a line.
Yeah, I mean. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say I'd be foolish to say there's no line.
Yeah, I mean, the line for me, at least on Twitter, was when I tweeted out that thing about John McCain, and it was Meghan McCain and John McCain in the first picture, and then the second picture was just Meghan McCain crying over John McCain's casket, and I captioned it, "Name a bigger upgrade," and sent it out. I think that was about my line. Like, I don't think I'd go too much beyond that, because that's very vicious and very cold hearted. But I mean, there's an overall point to it. Like, John McCain was a monster. He's a war criminal. He was responsible for the murder of, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So he should not be lionized at all. I mean, he's a piece of shit. He was a piece of shit when he was alive. He's a piece of shit now that he's dead. So I don't think there's any value to having any amount of respect for him. So I will shit on him incessantly. And I made a lot of people really angry with that post, but I think it was worth it. I think I had a point behind it, where some people might make a post like that, but there's just like there's no point behind it. But go ahead.
Well, I think the only reason that the people were so upset by that is that Meghan McCain clearly has different feelings about her dad than you did. If Meghan McCain had been out there being like, my dad was a war criminal scumbag who killed millions of innocent people, and you saw that photo, nobody would be upset with you. You know, right. If Meghan McCain was somebody who was, you know, it's literally just the feelings of that one person that everybody's worried about. So I agree with you. I also think that most people are, like, I think that's probably like close to the line, right? Because most people are going to be so hung up on Meghan McCain's feelings, even though she's not a great person either, right? You know, but the idea that she's right there and it's like, no, you're talking about, like, people are going to take that as like, name a better upgrade for your father. It's like the average person's father going from alive to dead. You know, it's like, realistically, like, Meghan McCain's a dumbass. You know, like, she has no, I don't think she has a realistic concept of what her dad was. And maybe he didn't even, you know, to be honest. But, like, a lot of fucking people died because of that dude. So when you put that out there, I'm like, no, it makes a lot of sense. And I guess the question is, are you going to reach people who are receptive, who are going to get it, who are not already a part of, like, on the same page with you? And honestly, does every fucking tweet have to be perfect like that and be like, well, this is going to reach our exact... That's another thing that people get so hung up on with the fucking libertarian messaging. Like, well, your strategy has to make sure it reaches the exact people who are not on our team yet, but who are about to be on our team, who are going to join only if you put this precise recipe out in the air. Like, do I have to make fucking spiced pumpkin bread too? Because I'm not gonna, okay?
Yeah, no, there's definitely that. I mean, I get... I love how... like, all... There can't be any joking or any sarcasm or any deviance from what your general messaging is. And I mean, you'll have, once you have a sizable following, you'll have trolls who come up on those posts and like, oh, wow, this doesn't look like, you know, what you preach all the time. It's like, dude, it's a joke, or, you know, it's in context with, I don't know. So, I mean, you're totally
right.
That
liberty hate.
Oh, yeah.
Or that unity hate.
Oh, yeah.
This doesn't look like unity.
Oh, yeah. I get that all the time. And I've already made all the disclaimers about the bitch fuck cucks and everything, but it doesn't matter. Like, people will be, you know, I'll say something bad about Donald Rumsfeld and they'll be like, this doesn't look like unity, or, you know, like, whatever. I mean, it's just inescapable. You can't do anything about it. But what is your, like, what do you think you... What do you think is your message or your flavor that you bring? Like, what are you really try to add to the space that you don't see? Is there enough, or do you think there is enough of what you want to add, but you just want to be part of it? Or what are your feelings in general on that?
I don't know. I'm not afraid of being unpopular with, like, your average everyday person. I think libertarians need to not be afraid to be unpopular, because the reality is, you're all libertarians, right? Do you have popular ideas? No. Yeah, I assume most of your listeners are libertarians, or at least, like, I don't know, some kind of, like, conservatarian-minded people. But we don't have popular ideas. So the idea to say this, you need to say it in the most popular way and be popular with this, is just silly to me. I'm here to say no. I guess I'm an anti-woke guy. I don't like the woke stuff, so I like to make fun of it. So I'm here for that. And then I like to rant. I don't know. I don't have anything specific. I'm just like a guy who likes to rant, and I can spend some time writing and going on podcasts or whatever, and making memes. I make some memes. But there's probably plenty of all of those in the space, to be honest. You know, although I won the Soapbox Idol thing, so I guess I have some ranting powers. I have like a little bit of a skill there. Maybe this flavor, I don't know, is there, maybe there's not enough of it. Who am I to say? Let the market decide.
That's right. Yeah, that's the biggest thing that bothers me about libertarians is they're like, you know, we need one message that everybody gets behind, or we need, you know, we all need to be on the same page and reaching the same people. And it's like, bullshit. You know, I'm going to reach different people than David Fite reaches, or than Justin Amash reaches, or even than like Pete Quinones reaches. Like, we're all going to have a different group of people that like to hear what we have to say. So, yeah, I mean, I think there should be like every flavor of our message, as long as we're all actually, you know, selling the same product. If you have someone who's saying they're a libertarian and they're selling imperialism, you know, then that's not okay. But as far as
the world,
yeah, exactly. Especially if they're the vice presidential nominee. You know, if you've got your own like flavor of messaging that works with a certain group of people, I think everyone should go for it. And like you said, I mean, the market will decide. That's what we say with everything else. So if the market decides, you know, what type of messaging works the best, seems like we should be going with that. But it seems like, you know, a lot of libertarians, they're kind of cronyists when it comes to messaging. They want not the government, but like the Libertarian Party putting a finger on the scale and like pushing certain people out and trying to exclude a certain type of messaging when it's like, hey, you know, aren't we about what works here? But apparently not.
Yeah, it's gross. I didn't know that was like what went on here. I just joined up with the LP like in January in New Hampshire. So obviously I've been along for the ride. But I didn't know that it was, I didn't know this was something, this is an organization where like people like, well, it's centralized control where the LNC will decide who's on your committees and who's kicked off based off of like things that are said on a freaking public chat room or whatever, where everybody is deciding who should own New Hampshire's private property. Like, okay, this is a very silly premise, especially when, if we're going to talk about, like, let's talk about the Jeremy Kaufman thing. I guess the LNC is going to do some, they're going to try him. They're going to do a trial or some shit. I don't know. I saw that in like the LNC business Google thread. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I saw that in there. I'm like, okay, so they're going to try him for saying, I don't know, I bet you this guy would suck my dick or something in a chat room, like to 100 people or whatever. When Nick Sarwark, didn't he say to like the entire LNC convention, like that was being broadcast live on TV across the nation, like eat my dick or whatever it was? What did he say?
I don't know. I don't remember.
I think he told the whole delegation to eat a dick or something. Like, so I'm like, no, okay, so did they try him? Like, I don't know. That's like a whole other libertarian moment in history. I'm like, you know, this is posturing, and I think that was Ben Richards that pointed that out. But it's clearly posturing. That's like,
yeah, it's a different standard. I mean, the amount of times libertarians online have done that type of stuff to each other, I mean, it's all the time. I mean, anyone who's on Liberty Twitter knows that type of thing happens all the time. But to make a big deal out of it now, just because of what's going on, yeah, that does seem to be kind of suspicious.
The only thing that I can see that this, you know, it's like this gravitational force, which is the opposition to the Mises Caucus, and any attempt to smear them and make them look as bad as possible. And so that's what this all is tied back into. It's like Trump derangement syndrome within the Mises or within the Libertarian Party and applying to the Mises Caucus rather than fucking Trump or whatever. It's the same thing, but for much less reason. I mean, at least Trump was like, actually, it's almost the same. It's like, we don't like the tweets.
Yeah,
no, it's literally the same thing. We don't like the tweets.
Yeah.
It'd be a whole different conversation if it was policy conversations. Like,
yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's what it is. I mean, if you look at the Mises, I'm in the Mises caucus now because I do agree with the platform. Welcome, 100%. Thank you. I appreciate it. But I agree with the platform 100%, and I like all the people in leadership that I know. And you're right. I mean, the derangement isn't about what their positions on the issues are. It's all about, oh, so-and-so said this 3 years ago, and I have a screenshot on Facebook. And then sometimes you even see the screenshot and you're like, okay, I'm not sure what emotion you're trying to get out of me on this comment. And then they tell you, but see, this happened and then this. And you're like, okay, I really don't care. But, you know, at Porkfest, it was very, I'd say, heavily Mises Caucus. There were a lot of Mises Caucus people there. A lot of the speakers were Mises Caucus people or Mises-friendly people. Dude, at Porkfest, there were nudists, there were Satanists, there were hippies. Like, there was people from all sorts of different walks of life. And I'm sure that people are trying to portray it as though it was some sort of alt-right rally or something based on who was speaking and what was said or whatever. And it's just so tiresome. These people need to get off of social media and they should go to some libertarian event where people aren't just there to shit on each other and they're actually there to just say, hey, we care about liberty and look at how many of us there are. Look at how different we all are. And honestly, the people in the Mises Caucus are way friendlier toward that idea than the other people that I've run into, at least. I mean, like so many of the Mises Caucus people have become friends with left-leaning people who are outside of the party, who are playing with it a little bit, or like playing with libertarianism. They'll have them on their shows and talk to them, and they'll friend them on Twitter, and they'll invite them to events or whatever, where these other, the BFCs, they're just isolationists. They don't want anyone new coming in. They just want people who have the exact same views they do on everything and use the exact same messaging and tone. So that's why I flipped on it. Like, a lot of people think I was, I'll admit, I was anti Mises Caucus at first, but it wasn't because of the reason most people are. For me, it was Jacob Hornberger. Like, I came into the Libertarian Party when he was running, and I just thought he was a horrible candidate. And so he was just like a really bad introduction to the Mises Caucus. And then I was kind of putting Jacob Hornberger as, you know, I was ascribing him to everyone in the Mises Caucus because the few interactions I had with people weren't great. But the more I've gotten to know people in it, and I've gotten to talk with, you know, different individuals from different states and all over the place, like, they are mostly selling exactly what I've always wanted, which is focusing on the important issues and not getting caught up in the stupid bullshit. And that's what, like, everyone else in the Libertarian Party is doing. So that's why I actually joined the caucus finally. But you joined, you said, when did you actually join the Libertarian Party? How recently was it?
Yeah, I joined in January, or maybe it was beginning of February, but I joined because of the Mises Caucus. I joined the Mises Caucus first, and they were all friendly to me. And then I joined the LP, and I went to the convention, and they were not all friendly to me. And then, like, I went to the Pennsylvania convention, and I met somebody who I was on, like, I was on the communications committee with. She has since quit. And I was like, oh, hey, I've never met you in person before. I just wanted to say hi, you know. And she basically within 2 minutes had told me, like, well, you know, I don't know you, but I have to assume you're racist until that I know that you're not racist because you're in the Mises Caucus. And I was like, wow, that's how we're doing things around here. All right. So Should I assume you're racist too until I know you well enough to know you're not racist? Like, that seems like a good way to deal with everybody you meet. Great. I was astonished. I could not believe that. And it's like, that's the people that we're dealing with here. So I was like, well, the Mises Caucus is clearly the home of the friendly people, and the Libertarian Party is clearly not, and that's why it needs to be taken over.
Well, I'm on the
We wouldn't have to take over if we could just join.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because the purging is all taking place from the opposite side. It's like the people that are trying to join, they're trying to purge all of them instead of this myth that, oh yeah, the Mises Caucus is going to come and stab everyone in the back and push them out. Like, I don't know, from my previously neutral perspective, it was all happening from one side. Maybe there was, I mean, I don't know, maybe some of it happened on the other side that I didn't notice in different states or something, but it seemed to be pretty much aimed at one group of people and being facilitated by another group of people. But what kept you away from the Libertarian Party before? Like, why did you just join now? Was it stupid, or was it a joke, or what was your thought of the Libertarian Party?
Yeah, I guess I never really took it seriously. Like, coming from the Ron Paul days, like, Ron Paul was such a badass, and seeing, like, you know, those 2008, 2012 was like when I really got on board with it. 2008, like I said, was an Obama kid or whatever. But 2012, having that, and then having Gary Johnson in 2016, and he's like kind of dopey, you know, like a nice enough guy, but kind of dopey. And then I saw the whole Hillary Trump thing, and I was like, I'm not voting. Mm-hmm. You know, and then, like, I didn't in the local elections, you know, I probably should have cared more. I do think that matters more, but there's nobody that caught my eye. I didn't know that there were, dude, I live in New Hampshire. I didn't know there were fucking local libertarians running for office. They're everywhere. There's like a whole slew of them. They've got multiple gangs in New Hampshire of libertarians. But so I was like, just kind of keeping my head. I'm like, I don't know. I want people to be left alone. So I guess I went more of like a opting out. Like, I was a voluntary non-participant in that bullshit.
Yeah. So what got what got you involved now, other than the Mises Caucus? Like, what issues are pressing? Did the lockdowns like make you think, okay, I got to do something, or was it anything like that? Or
the lockdowns and inflation. You know, I've been worried about, you know, the inflation coming for a long time, but the lockdowns in combination with the massive printing of money, you know, the fiscal cliff, they talked about that like 10 years ago, like, oh, we're approaching the fiscal cliff, we'll never be able to recoup our debt. I'm like, well, I think we've gone, they stopped talking about it for a reason. So I was always worried there's gonna be a massive like economic collapse of some sort where we're all gonna need to kind of fend for ourselves a lot more than we do. So between that and then the lockdowns, where you see, I guess before the lockdowns happened, I thought that most people would not have accepted such a thing. You know, in February, I went out to California to work on a farm for the beginning of the year. This is last year, 2020. And the coronavirus is already going around in China. And they'd already locked down. There was like videos of people dropping down the streets. And then there was videos of them welding people into their homes. And I flew to California knowing this virus was going around. And I told my girlfriend, like, you know, I don't think that this is going to happen here. If it comes here, people would never put up with it. And I was fucking 100% wrong, you know. Because I thought, you know, I'm like, Americans love freedom. We do want to be free. We'd never put up with that kind of thing. Also, like, who's going to make the food or whatever. But I didn't even think, like, well, they'll have this essential and non-essential workers thing. You know, I didn't realize kind of how sneaky the government can be, but also how subservient people are willing to be in most cases. So when that happened, I started going, I was on the farm and working, you know, like where I was, we didn't lock down. We had a fucking set of crops to grow. So I'm working 12, 14 hour days outside, just listening to Tom Woods all day long and Dave Smith and like whatever other like good, like actually solid information that I can listen to. All day long, like just trying to get as much information that is not clearly state propaganda on the lockdowns, the virus, on what's going on in the world. Because I was literally in the most isolated, remote area of California. And so between all that, you know, the Mises Caucus had the best messaging coming through the lockdown. The Libertarian Party had nothing. And everybody from the Mises Caucus was like, no, this is wrong. They have no right to do this. Also, they were right on point with the money issues. And I was like, coming out of that, I'm like, all right, you know, I'm joining the Mises Caucus, however that goes. And luckily, right when I got back from the farm at the end of last year, I was already in the national Facebook group. But Ben Richards, who's our state organizer here in New Hampshire, who's one of the greatest dudes I know, reached out to me. He's like, hey, you should come to our next meeting in January. And they, I guess in December, they had a meetup and there was 6 people there. In January, they had 35. In February, we had another one. There's like 40 people and like most of them or half of them were different people. And then we went to convention and we're like the majority of the delegation already. It was nuts. So like the steam and the momentum were there. Now I'm all in, baby. Like, let's go. We had the biggest venue at Porkfest. So that's what got me in, is just like the Mises Caucus and then the just good messaging through the lockdowns and, you know, meeting people like this. Like all the people I met in New Hampshire and then just all the Mises Caucus people I've met across the country through podcasts or whatever. I mean, I've only been more and more enthused. Kind of like you were saying, the more people you meet, the more you're like, wow, this is like the home of the energy and the momentum and where people are actually getting new libertarians involved, but also people who are libertarians who are like not involved to come feel like this is worthwhile, like worth doing. Like there's actually like a team we can all be on to fight. And I'm not like saying we need to all believe exactly the same thing, but there's people out there. And I say this all the time, people out there every single day planning to control you, planning to tell you how much of your money you can keep, you know, how far you can stand from your grandmother, when you can open your fucking business. Fucking good. If we were willing to be on a team of some sort, even like a loosely fitting ragtag team of like, nope, we're all going to say no, no matter how unpopular. Like that's what I'm here for. And it seems like the Mises Caucus is that.
Yeah, you know the old saying, most people are libertarian, they just don't know it yet.
Yeah, I know that saying.
It's completely wrong. I think most people are tyrants without power. So that's actually why I'm a libertarian, why I'm an anarchist, because I don't want people to have power over other people, because I think that they do want... I think there's an inherent desire to control others. I think it's just natural. I don't know. I think that's become so obvious over the last year. And I think that people, I think we need a revolution of the mind. You know, I think so many people are focused on just going after one issue and trying to make people better on that one issue, where to me, the problem is that we've just fostered such a compliant society. You know, to me, this wasn't just about government. Like, this was about supply lines and things just breaking down, like realizing how many people in Salt Lake City would die if the supply line stopped for 2 weeks. You know, nobody can take care of themselves anymore. There's zero self-reliance. No one grows their own food. They're completely dependent on the grid. It's just so obvious that we need to decentralize and go back to community, go back to, you know, self-preservation and taking care of your friends and family, because that fell apart this last year. I mean, people were out for themselves. They were, you know, they were hoarding toilet paper and hoarding food, and they just lost any form of decency or any form of caring for each other. And I think a lot of people pair individualism with selfishness, and I think it's the opposite. I think individualism, if you're a good person at least, shows the importance in your willingness to step up and be responsible and take care of yourself and take care of your family and friends and those who need help around you. I don't know. I guess I'm just a little hopeless, you know. Like, I am excited, like, seeing what's happening in the Liberty movement, but I think, I don't know. I think we really need to be pushing philosophy, you know, which is what the Mises Caucus does. Actually, they push the philosophy of self-ownership and non-aggression, which is something that the Libertarian Party hasn't really, they haven't really focused on in recent elections. You know, they'll talk about, oh, well, we think about this, about the war on drugs, and we think this about occupational licensing laws or whatever. It's never about, this is why we believe this. You know, it was never, we think that government power is illegitimate and they have no right to tell you that you have to stay in your house. And so, I don't know. It's great seeing the new direction of the Libertarian Party. I just hope we can sell that message and have it catch on, because to me, that's the downfall. What do you think about that?
So I think it'll catch on to some people. Let me give you a little bit of hope if I can, or if I can try. When you say most people are tyrants who don't have power, I don't know if I agree with that any more than I agree with most people being libertarians who don't know it. I think most people want to be led and they want to be accepted. And so tyrants without power, I guess maybe, and that in the last year, we kind of created a culture where tyrants without power are rewarded with like social justice points or something. It's like a weird conglomeration of the social justice culture where, you know, you have to feel good. Like I'll tell you, even if I have no power to make you wear a mask, I'll be like, I saw someone at the grocery store not wearing a mask, and I told them right off that they should be wearing a mask. And I'll tell my friends that for the social points. And it's like, yeah, are you actually a tyrant? Are you actually going to? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, just to interject. I mean, I think tyrant doesn't necessarily mean leader. I think you could be a tyrant and a follower at the same time, you know?
Well, but even somebody with no intention or ability to enforce such a thing, whereas a tyrant can and will, it's somebody who literally wants the points, like the social points, you know, it's like popularity thing. So don't overestimate or underestimate the power of that, because what it does is it makes it look like there's a bunch more people who actually want to control you than really are willing or able to control you or even have any willpower to control you. It's literally a point. They're scoring points on somebody else's scorecard. You know, if you're in the grocery store and you're doing the unpopular thing, everybody else is keeping score, right? of like whether you're doing the popular thing, whether Reed's popular or Bill's popular. And if Bill tells you that you should be wearing your mask, everybody else is like, point for Bill. He told Reed to do the responsible thing. Also, dock the point for Reed. He did the irresponsible thing. And so like, even if I have no intention or desire to make you wear a fucking mask, I can pretend to be as upset as I want. But like so much of it, I feel, is really a show in the social justice era. Yeah, and I could be wrong, you know, but that's my thought on that. And I think libertarians in the Mises Caucus specifically have a chance to lead people and to tell people like, hey, it's okay. Like, you don't have to fucking freak out about this bitch shit. Like, this is some stupid, petty stuff. Let me point you to where the real problems are, because we're worrying about microaggressions and then we're doing some real macroaggressions on a fucking global scale here. So let's talk about that. You know, you can put your petty stuff aside and stop figuring out how to be worried about who looked you the wrong way in the grocery store or whether somebody used the right word to address you. And it's like, no, there's people dying.
Yeah. No, I hope you're right. And I think what we've got to do is we've got to connect emotion with logic. And because, I mean, everyone else has thrown logic out the window. You know, they don't have any logic to their philosophies anymore. And it doesn't matter. Like, people don't care about logic. But we have to maintain logic, or we're going to become irrelevant. That's the only reason we still exist, is because we are logical and we're the consistent ones. But we have to figure out how to pair that with emotion, because that's what draws people in. You can have the most logical argument and put someone to sleep and they won't care. That I also see from the Mises Caucus, is the ability to pair logic with passion and with emotion. That's what Ron Paul did. That's what Donald Trump had a lot less logic, but you know, emotion, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders, you know, like any of these people, they all used emotion to pull people in, but then they didn't have any logic to back it up. I feel like we can really bring people in with emotion and pair it with logic that's actually sound. And that's how we win, which is kind of what you were just saying. I mean, it's, you know, if you could tell people that we're murdering civilians overseas so microaggressions aren't the end of the world, you know, that seems to have a logical and a compelling emotional argument at the same time.
And, you know, I think most people, if they were more aware of what's going on overseas, would care a little bit more about it. You know, I don't think most people are going to fucking quit their job over a war or something, but you can get them on your side. I think most people are like open, they're receptive to a more sound cause, but nobody's talking about it. So we bring the emotion on two levels too. We bring the passion, because there are a lot of passionate folks here in the Mises Caucus. And we also bring like an emotional appeal, which is like, hey, we know you're worried about people's feelings. Imagine how worried about you are about people's lives. You know, like, you're worried about how somebody feels when they hear the wrong word. Imagine how they feel if a bomb dropped on their head and they didn't do anything. You know, if you're the compassionate person, here's something that we should be worried about, because we're compassionate too. And it's like, we could be dickheads online or whatever, but like, for real, we care about human lives and human suffering in a much bigger, much grander scale than most people are talking about. Like, look at all there's nobody in the Republican or Democrat parties with the passion of the libertarians, as far as I can tell. I guess maybe the MAGA group has like a certain level of passion, but it's about like a guy. It's not like about what they believe in. It's like about a dude.
Yeah.
And he's fucking old, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't know how much they believe in him as much as they believe like, this guy said no. And it's like, that tells you something. Democrats have literally nothing to be enthused about. I mean, literally nothing. It's like, they already got everything they wanted. Now they're like trying to figure out, they finally have like run out of rope. Like, what are we sticking out next? Because all their next ideas are super duper unpopular. Like, all their next fucking ground they've staked out is super duper unpopular. So they're like grasping at straws. It seems like, you know, when Dave Smith says there's no stopping an idea, or whoever said that originally, there's no stopping an idea whose time has come. It's like, the idea is that like, hey, all these fuckers are robbing us. I think that people are more receptive to that than ever, because almost everybody is like, yeah, we're getting robbed. Like, I ask people, like, we're getting taxed at a record rate, right? If you live in the average state, before you get your paycheck, or before, if you're, let's say you own the company, before you can pay your employees, you get taxed 20% on every dollar of profit. And then you go to pay your employees, before they get their paycheck, they get taxed at 20%. They go to spend it at the cash register. They're taxed at 10%. It's like you're left, the average person is left with 57% of their dollar or something in buying power. Well, let me ask you, average person, are you getting 43% back for every single dollar that you earn from the U.S. government? Like, are you getting that value from the U.S. government? No. Well, let's be generous and say, is the fucking homeless disenfranchised person on the bench getting it? Well, we have a record homeless problem in this country. Let's go ask them. Are you getting 43% of every single American dollar earned by every single American in the country? The answer is no. And that's a very easy message to pitch. Nobody's got that enthusiasm or that level of like cognitive or emotional appeal anywhere in the political spectrum besides the Mises Caucus, as far as I can tell. I mean, I can give you like the most compelling pitch for why I believe what I believe in like under 2 minutes right there. And most people be like, well, you got kind of a point there. Even if they disagree with it, like you got kind of a point there.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree, man. it doesn't get any easier to make our message appealing than right now. I'll just put it that way. Like, I mean, all everything is laid out in it's a perfect scenario for us to prove that we're right. So everyone who's watching, go join the Libertarian Party and join the Mises Caucus. Let's try to make a difference. But Bill, thanks for coming on. You and I are both in free speech media, and we've talked a lot of messaging, and we met in person. And I was like, dude, I got to get you on my show. I feel bad that I haven't already. And so I'm glad we did it. It was a good discussion. I like the way you think. Where can people keep up with you? I got your Twitter in the description, so people could follow you there. But what else you want to plug? What else you want to say before we end the show?
Follow Free Speech Media Network on Facebook. Find me on Facebook if you want, and find me on Twitter with it's Bill is a joke, all one word. I'll be dropping a video pretty soon about the Overton window, which is like a little animated thing. So keep your eyes peeled for that. That's all I got. All right. Thanks for having me, man.
Yeah, that was great. We'll do it again. Thanks everyone for watching. Subscribe to the channel if you haven't. I will be live streaming tomorrow night with Dak Rouleau. And I've been uploading these to Anchor and audio format afterwards. So this will be up within a couple days. Go check me out there on Spotify, Apple, you know, everywhere you can find a podcast from Anchor. I have audio versions now. Thank you for watching.